non-alcoholic. My name is Victoria.
Hi, Victoria.
Thank you. I love you guys, too. And for the record, I will not be taking off my shirt. I've been sober a little too long for that. All right. It's, wow. This is really amazing. Thank you so much to the host committee for asking me to speak tonight. And, you know, can we get a round of applause for the host committee? I know that these things seem like they just pop up, but, you know, conventions, even ones outdoors, take a lot of planning and prayer and traditions and a lot of prayer. So I'm really glad to be here tonight. And as I was introduced, I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and that's where I live. That's where I was raised, and we have our little crew over there. So they're gonna be hosting the dance party later, so if you wanna see what Colorado's all about, you should come to the dance party.
Rocking down high!
But before, I'm gonna share some experience, strength, and hope with you. So my sobriety date is October 13, 2007. And, you know, by the grace of a higher power that I choose to call God today, a fellowship that is much like this, if not bigger, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink in, for me, what is a really long time. You know, and I'm going to share tonight, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. You know, and in the beginning when I share, I kind of like to do a little housekeeping things. Especially to those people who are new, because I feel like I have your attention for maybe 5 to 10 more minutes if you're new. So I want to get the important stuff out of the way. So first off, you know, that sobriety countdown was super amazing, and I had heard that there was someone with 3 days. And that's amazing. 3 days is a long, long time for an alcoholic. You know, I called a treatment center before I got sober, and they wanted me to not drink for 5 days. And I said, dude, that's why I'm calling you. I can't not drink for 5 days. That's the problem. So, you know, to the person that has 3 days, that's amazing. You know, props to you. The other thing I really, I like sobriety countdowns. They're fun and there's a lot of energy. Also, YPOP pro tip, it's really good to know who you can and cannot date during sobriety countdowns. Just a little note. So, you know, if you're new, you hear a lot of things. And these conventions are really fun, and I believe for me, they're a way to have fun and have fellowship, but also like we convey a message of hope. And maybe you haven't heard that message yet, or maybe you're trying to be reminded of that message. I went to my first YPOW when I was 5 years sober, and so I needed to hear another message of hope. And so we convey a message, we put these things on to convey a message of hope to the sick and suffering alcoholic. And that doesn't necessarily mean the person who's new. And, you know, you hear a lot of things in AA, especially if you're new, that are like, keep coming back. And for me, you know, I like to always kind of add things to that because I like the idea of the keep coming back. And if coming back is a revolving door for you, that's okay. We can work with that too. But something I really liked that was a step further than keep coming back is just don't drink between meetings. You know, and even if your between meetings is a day, hours, weeks, months, years, you know, just don't drink between meetings, you know, and don't pick up a drink and you have a chance, no matter what your present circumstance is. You know, the other thing we tell people when they first come in here is to get a sponsor. And, you know, I have a sponsor today. I've always had a sponsor. Well, let me rephrase that. There was a period of time where I was my sponsor. I don't recommend that. But, you know, generally I've had a sponsor, and a sponsor is somebody who has some experience, strength, and hope, who has, you know, worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and has had a spiritual experience. And like I said, I like to take those things a bit further because the slogan we say is, find somebody that has something you want. And the very first person I ever asked to sponsor me when I came into the rooms had a really nice car, really nice good-looking boyfriend, you know, a big house, and lots of money and a job. And those were things I wanted. And the thing is I had no idea what her spirituality was like, what her insides, you know, were like. And I made a decision based upon all the outside stuff. And for me today, this program is very, very much about what's going on the inside. Because I can make myself look good. You know, that's what I did well before I picked up a first drink was I knew how to con people into thinking that I was okay. You know, because I was afraid if you really knew what was going on in between my ears, you wouldn't like me, you wouldn't accept me, and you wouldn't love me. And so for me today, the people that have what I want are people who live a life of authenticity and people who have like some really cool stuff going on the inside. And what I mean by that is, you know, you see their you know, the spirituality, you see them, they're the same kind of people that they're gonna say the same thing in a meeting and they're gonna be the same person outside the meeting. You know, and the thing is, and why that's super important is because that sponsor that I had asked that had all these cool outside things, when I was 5 years sober, I 12-stepped her and I walked her out of a bar. She had gone back out after a number of years of sobriety. And, you know, I'm not sure all the details and why, but for me today, I know that I need to continue to grow spiritually in this thing. And I need to keep showing up, and I need to keep putting pen to paper and doing the work, and I need to keep trusting that there's a power greater than me that, like, keeps me here. And the more that I do that, the bigger that power gets. You know, so I'll touch a little, somewhat on what it was like. And the thing is I try not to go too much into like what it was like, because the fact is if you've crossed and made it through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you kind of get an idea of what it was like. It's not like we arrive here because we're winning or really good at drinking. That's kind of why we get here. And so, you know, for me, the other thing is I know that for me, alcoholism doesn't have to do with where I was raised, you know, whether there was alcohol in my home or not, because I grew up in the white picket fence town in a suburb of Boulder, Colorado, and I had parents who I was raised really religiously. I'm in Utah, so you can kind of guess, like, there's a number of religions that don't drink, and so I was raised in a religion that it was not okay to drink, and so I didn't grow up around alcohol. There was no alcohol in my home, so I know today that my upbringing doesn't really have a bearing on whether I'm an alcoholic or not. But things that do have a bearing, and that I had started, for me, I believe I had symptoms at a really early age. And what does have a bearing is my main problem in being an alcoholic is the way that I think. I think and perceive life differently. And I say that because, you know, I'm different. But, you know, I had other kids who felt different. You know, I was one of the few biracial kids, if not the only biracial kid in the neighborhood. And so the other biracial kids, sometimes I might ask them, how does that feel to be different? And they're like, we don't really think about it. But me, I was constantly thinking about it. I was constantly thinking how uncomfortable it made me. And I was constantly taking action on that uncomfortable feeling. And that action looked like, I'm going to go to school and I'm gonna get straight A's. Or I'm going to try to be the best that I can be at everything. And if I couldn't be the best at something, then I didn't want to do it. Which is really like setting myself up there. Like there was no middle. There was no in between. And so, you know, my parents are really amazing people. And, you know, they're not perfect. Nobody is. But they did the best that they could. And they said that I was a really good kid. And, but I just, you know, seemed a little anxious and a little like neurotic, and I was always stressed out. And so the thing for me is I didn't take my first drink of alcohol till I went to CU Boulder.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, go Buffs. And I remember being 18 and I left the house and I got invited to that cool kids party because I never felt good enough or like cool. And so I got invited to that one party, and we all know that party. You know, and you feel like you've arrived. And it's like the wind was blowing in my hair, and I was like, yeah. And, you know, I had always felt like I didn't belong, and I felt like I was missing something. I always felt like something and a piece of me was missing. And, you know, I had done other things long before I picked up a first drink to kind of fill that missing piece. You know, I thought boys were super cool when I was 14. You know, I thought food was, like, awesome. Like, mac and cheese was my jam, you know. And I always, like, I never knew how to moderate things. It was always in excess, you know. I slept in excess. I ate in excess. You know, I would cling to relationships in excess. And so I didn't know how to moderate things. But that first time that I took that first drink, that was the thing more than anything else that made me feel like I was okay. Like I had arrived, you know? And the thing is as I'm getting a little older, I feel like and life happens, I feel like I forget things, you know? Like I could not tell you what I had for lunch yesterday, but the thing is I can tell you exactly what the room smelled like, who was there, what it looked like that night that I took my first drink. I can remember the taste, I can remember so many details about that. And for me, that's a sign that I think about alcohol differently than maybe somebody who isn't an alcoholic. You know, I go to this party and I start drinking beer and it's great and I'm standing on tables and dancing and then falling off tables, you know, I have this perception like what it looks like that I'm super cool. And then my coworkers told me later, it was like, no, you like fell off the table, you busted your knee, and then you started screaming Cookie Monster because you wanted cookies. And then we had to take you home, and then you wouldn't go inside. So we like left you passed out in your parents' lawn and like ran away because we didn't want to get in trouble because you were like 16. And when I heard that, I still was like, that was the greatest night of my life, and I can't wait to do it again. So I remember like coming to in my parents' lawn and like crawling upstairs and thinking, wow, this was really great, you know, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And the thing is I didn't draw a sober breath for the next 5 years. And what turned in what I thought was like this fun, like cute, like party moment, like it progressed really quickly for me. I started sneaking into bars, and I did a lot of geographical cures because I thought that my problem wasn't the alcohol, and it certainly wasn't me. It was, you know, everything around me. It was my family. It was, you know, my significant other at the time. It was my job. It was all these things. So I moved a lot, and I ended up in Texas when I was about 18 years old, or 18, 19, and I started sneaking into bars. And the thing is I remember my favorite bar down there because that was the kind of bar that would serve me alcohol in the way I like to be served. And it was in a pitcher. Not a pitcher to share with anybody. Like, I didn't realize that pitchers were what people put at parties to share drinks. I thought it was something that was designed to serve just me. You know, and by pitcher, it was a pitcher of alcohol. Like, it wasn't beer, it wasn't like, I wanted the hard stuff. And I would find these places that would serve me because I, excuse me, I'm kind of recovering from pneumonia. So it's so funny because before I got sober, I was in hospitals a lot. And I remember I'd overdose and then I'd like go get drunk again. And so it's really cool that today, like I can still like be sick in a hospital and like still like recover and like come and do things because I was willing to go to any lengths to get drunk. But, you know, when I was drinking in Texas, I went to the places that I could sneak in. I was too afraid to get a fake ID because I was afraid of getting in trouble. But you know, I'm like driving drunk and super stoned all around San Antonio in blackouts, you know. But I can't get a fake ID because that's a little too far. But for me, I didn't realize there's this line in the book that talks about the alcoholic thinks their life is the only normal one. And I thought it was completely normal. I thought everybody went out, started out with a few, lost count, blacked out, maybe ended up at home, maybe didn't, lose their keys, lose their car, have unknown bruises on their bodies, like lose their phones, like wallets. Like I thought that was normal. I thought everybody else was doing that. Like why wouldn't you do that? That makes sense. And so much so that when I first got introduced to AA, it was in California, and my sponsor at the time had me do that little questionnaire that's like, check yes if you've done this. And I did not check the blackout box because I didn't think blackouts were abnormal. And so, but there were a couple things that happened in San Antonio for me that that were kind of earmarkers of this disease. And what they were is, you know, and I talk about other substances besides alcohol, not because I don't, you know, respect the traditions, but because there was a lot of other things that I did that kind of mixed in that really pushed me over the edge. I mean, I drank for 5 years. So essentially I've been sober twice as long as I drank. But the drugs adding into my story is what brought me down really quickly. So I was chilling at my house on a Friday night, you know, getting my weekend on, which was usually started with a six pack and a bottle of Vicodin. And one night in particular, I had done maybe a little more than the usual, and I panicked. And I remember sitting in my apartment and I was panicked, and I thought, wow, maybe I did a little too much. And it wasn't so much that I thought I did a little too much because I didn't like the way that I felt. I thought I did a little too much because I didn't want to die. I felt great, but I didn't want to die. I didn't want to face that consequence yet. And later on in my story, and that's how I know this thing is progressive, later on in my story, I didn't care if I died. Like, I would ask, like, people would drop me off at hospitals. They'd pump me with the drugs that, you know, made me, like, not, my heart not almost explode, and I'd go back out and do it. But at this point, when I was about 19, I didn't want to die. And so I thought that a really good idea, because, you know, once again, my thinking is what's broken, is to drive myself to the hospital to have them pump my stomach. Have it, I've done a bottle of Vicodin and like a 24-pack. And the part that I note about that later on in years was pointed out to me, is that I want to go to the hospital because I thought I did too much, that I might need medical attention, but I'm okay to drive. Just saying. So I get in my car, I drive myself to the hospital, and then I realize that I don't know where the hospital is. And so I call 911 and ask them for directions. That made sense. And so they ask me, well, why do you need to go to the hospital, miss? And I tell them, because once again, I thought that there was nothing abnormal with the way that I was drinking and drugging. And the dispatcher, obviously concerned, asked me to pull over. And I questioned why, because it didn't make sense to me, you know? And the book, you know, and the steps, it talks about insanity, you know, that God restores us to sanity. So I had a sponsor once tell me, you know, that's kind of hinting that you're insane. And she would remind me of things like this when I needed to be reminded that I have an insane line of thinking. My thinking is so insane that I thought that night that I was gonna drive myself to the hospital completely intoxicated and that there was nothing wrong with that. So I show up to the hospital, they pump my stomach, they do the thing, and they restrain me. And they tell me I have to go on a 72-hour hold. And I asked why. And then the doctor comes in and he says something that I'll never forget. He said, why did you take all of that? And I looked at him and I said, because I wanted to get high. And he said, Victoria, nobody takes the amount of drugs and alcohol that you do without the intent to hurt themselves. And I swore up and down I wasn't trying to hurt myself. And that was the truth. That's the thing, is that was the truth. I was not trying to hurt myself. I was just trying to chase a really good high. And so they put me on a 72-hour hold. I actually sobered up the next day, and then they were like, well, we don't think you need to be here. So then they, you know, released me back into the wild. And yeah, I continued to do what I was doing. You know, and so I ended up in California a few years later on another geographical. And that's when things started to really get heavy. I started ending up in parties and really just being lost, you know, and LA is not a town that you want to be drunk and lost in. And that's when, though, the progression started happening and then I stopped caring. I just wanted to not feel anything. You know, the book talks about, you know, drink to oblivion, and that was the state that I wanted. You know, I didn't, you know, it talked about drinking like a gentleman or a lady, and I didn't know what that meant. You know, I was a waitress at the time, and we would have these wine tasting classes, you know, for training. And they would pass around the bucket, and I thought that was the most absurd thing. Because apparently you're supposed to spit out the wine in the bucket. And I thought, why? That's a waste. So, you know, I'm in LA, and I'm doing my thing. And I was going to, you know, therapy for other things. Because drinking was not my problem. Drinking was the solution to my life. It is how I coped with life. It's how I dealt with life. And so, but I remember one particular night, and here's the thing that, for me, part of being an alcoholic is that I might be able to stop for a short time, but on my own, I do not have the willpower to completely stop drinking on my own, no matter how much I want to. And so I kind of go through this unmanageability cycle where, like, I'd stop drinking for a couple weeks because I wanted to, like, kind of seem like I got my stuff together. And I get a new job and a new apartment and new boyfriend of the week. And then I would pick up a drink. And then, like, all of that stuff would go away in, like, a night, because that's how much of a tornado I was when I drank. You know, all bets were off. You know, and I didn't care, and I didn't care who I hurt, and I didn't care, you know, the consequences. And I figure, well, I'll just sober up, and I'll move over here and just do this over again. But what had happened in one of those, like, you know, changes is that I got this new job, and I went out with some people from work, and I was trying really hard to not drink. But I just remember the smell and being just so enamored and thinking, you know, well, I can have just one, right? Like, that's gonna be fine. And then, you know, my boss was like, well, let me buy you a shot. And I was like, okay, of course you can. And somehow I went from, I'm gonna have just one, to being so drunk I had to be carried down the city walk stairs, which there's about 100 of them. My coworkers were really not happy with me that night. Be put in my sister's car and, you know, taken to an emergency room. And I didn't think anything was wrong with that. So, you know, for me, this program is a spiritual program. And, like, you know, the next half is where I talk a lot about God. And, like, I was super agnostic when I got here. If people talked about God, I did not want to hear it. I used to flip old ladies off in the meeting when they talk about God. because I thought, like, I was raised, I was raised Mormon. And I thought that I had tried. You know, I'd go back to church, or I'd go back to, like, you know, the 10 different Sunday schools, and I thought that I tried. I thought I had tried God. But I realized then that I tried somebody else's concept of God. I never tried my own conception of God. And that's the difference. And so, and this is interesting in that, as much as I struggled with that, my first 12-step call came from a woman from the Mormon church. And she was just a friend who was visiting to check on how I was doing. And she came to my home, and I was super hungover. And that was the first time somebody had questioned my drinking. You know, and she had said, have you ever thought that maybe you're an alcoholic? And nobody had asked me that before. And I thought, what does that mean? And it's so funny, because a few years ago, I had found the card she wrote me, and it was, like, written in, like, code that I didn't understand then, I do today. And she's like, if you want a list of where the meetings are, call this number, central office. And if you want the book, you know, I can get you one of those. And you should go to those meetings, and, you know, I'll help you. And I remember walking into a meeting on Ventura Boulevard, and everybody gave me a hug, and I thought it was really freaking weird. And they gave me their phone numbers, and I thought that was even more weird. And then they gave me a book, and they said call them. And then I called this lady the next day, and she was like, I can't take your call because I'm working. And I thought that was really weird too. So I never went back. And so for me, you know, I didn't think that I had a problem. And then eventually I ended up in treatment in California. And I thought, oh, okay, well, this is cool. Like, it was like the Passions Malibu type treatment, you know? I sat in the sun, we sang a lot of Kumbaya, there was a lot of guitars, you know, they would take me to meetings, and, you know, but the thing is, and that's why I do a lot of treatment work today, is that there were people that would come into the meetings and share their experience, drink, and hope, and they were, like, people who were, like, living on Skid Row, doing drugs that I couldn't even name. So I thought, you know, nice girls from Boulder, Colorado, who maybe drink a little too much, don't belong in AA. Not true, by the way. So I really kind of checked out. And but because I didn't want to be homeless, I checked into a sober living house, and, like the good egg that I can be, I did all the things that they asked me to do. They told me to go to meetings every day. I went to meetings every day. They told me to get a sponsor and call them every day. I called my sponsor every day. You know, they told me to, you know, read the big book. I read it every day. I had no clue what it meant, but I read it. And I did not realize that At the time, I was dealing with a disease that was beyond my mental control, that I was completely powerless over, because I had done all these things that people suggested. And then I went out to watch a band play, and I got drunk, and I was devastated. I had had like 9 months at the time, and I had done this, like, I graduated from Passion Malibu or whatever, and I had done what they had asked me to, and how is it that I still drank? And that was when things got dark, because I think for us, the hopelessness that it talks about before we get here, and that's the beautiful, beautiful thing about sobriety and AA and what we do here, because we have hope here. That's why people keep coming back. That's why people show up. That's why even if you're scared, even if you've been out there, even if you don't know what to do or if it's even gonna work, you show up because there's hope here. But that, before we get the hope, we need the hopeless. And for me, the hopeless look like not feeling like AA worked because I did what all the things that I thought you told me to do. And that's why I love that saying that people say, meeting makers make it, but step takers get to keep it. Because that has been my truth. Because that's been a big difference from the time that I was going to meetings and just saying like, hi, I'm Victoria, I'll read the promises at the end of the meeting, to today where I have worked the steps. I've taken other women through the steps and it's completely changed my life. You know, but to back up what the hopelessness looked like is that I felt like AA wouldn't work for me. And so I just went out there and I just put more and more in. I thought AA couldn't work for me. I thought God had abandoned me and I thought that I had nothing. And I continued to drink and drug so much so that 2007, I remember March and I remember October 11th. I cannot tell you what really transpired in those months. I've had some friends kind of help fill in some of the blanks, but some of it is gone. And the thing is when I was kind of going to meetings and just, you know, not really participating, something I had heard that I didn't think was true is they talked about the progressiveness of this disease. And they said it gets worse out there. And I thought that didn't apply to me because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I think a lot of things don't apply to me. But that was so true because it went from being this, oh, I'm this like party girl, we're having fun, to I became homeless, I became jobless. And the thing is I didn't get fired from a job, I quit. My job got in the way of my drinking. You know, I worked in an office and at 10 o'clock in the morning, I was researching where to go for happy hour. I thought it was socially unacceptable to drink before noon, except for on holidays, like all of them. So I would try to like plan my drink. And I didn't realize that what that was is the obsession of the mind. You know, that's what my sponsor had told me, that this is the obsession of the mind, that I cannot, you know, stop thinking about things. And I obsess about it because I'm restless, irritable, discontent until I get that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And so I am, you know, I don't know what happened in that time, but what I do know is that I started showing up at hospitals so frequently that there is a hospital in Colorado outside Boulder that knew me on first name basis. And it got so bad that the nurses there were like, Victoria, either go to treatment or just go die in the street. We are tired of wasting our resources on you because you are unwilling to do anything to get yourself sober or to get yourself help. Clearly you have a problem, but you're not even willing to admit it. And so instead I was like, okay, I'm just gonna go to a different hospital. And I kept doing it. And the thing is a few months before I got sober, how I became homeless, though I wouldn't have told you at the time I was homeless, I was couch surfing, you know, I was a professional couch surfer. That's not the same as being homeless, right? And I remember my dad, I was 23 years old. I was 23 when I got sober. And so in 2007, I was 23, and I remember my dad taking me aside and sent me down, and he said, Victoria, me and your mom have doubled your life insurance. We have doubled your life insurance because we, with more assurity, believe that we will bury you before you will get sober. And then my mom came in and she was crying and she was like, please help me plan your funeral. We know you are not going to live to be 25. So I did, And then they told me that they couldn't watch me die, that I needed to go somewhere else because they refused to watch me die. And the thing is I look back on that today, and I'm not a parent, but I love my parents, and I can't imagine how much strength that took. You know, I found out years later they were secretly going to Al-Anon, and they pulled out some black belt Al-Anon tools on me. But the strength that it took to let me go so much that they had accepted my death. And so I went out there for a few more months, and that's the thing, and I realized how powerful, like it talks about cunning, baffling, and powerful. Oh my. Is that I would love to tell you that, you know, chat with my parents was enough to get me sober. It wasn't. You know, I continued to doing what I was doing and drinking every day, overdosing every day. I had already left work. I didn't have any more money. All my relationships were gone except for one. And the thing is there was this one guy, one person who said he would hang out with me. And he told me, he said, I'm only hanging out with you, Victoria, because I pity you. And also because if I leave you alone, you're going to die. And I don't want that on my conscience. And the thing is he took me to the hospital every other day for 2 weeks. So he's probably right. And that I am standing here today because of him and him part, like for a lot of reasons, but one of them is him and his willingness to just do the right thing. And you know, for me, what happened, and I love the book when it talks about what God is. Like, I love We Agnostics because, like I said, I was atheist, I was agnostic, kind of atheist. I flipped old ladies off. I didn't want to talk about God. I said I would do every step except the ones that included God. Can we just skip those? And but for me today, what I realize is that on October 13th, you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, it wasn't of my own thinking that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'll tell you, on October 11th was my last drink. And I had overdosed, and I was in the hospital, and it was, you know, I was restrained. And the thing is that guy had taken me. And this was one of the few that I actually remember. And I remember coming to, and I remember the nurse, you know, telling me they ran a toxicology, and I had a lot of stuff in me. But they said that I was minutes away from my heart exploding in my chest and dying instantly. And I remember the nurse looking at me and saying, is it enough? And the thing is I realized that my last drink was my last drink because I needed one more to prove to myself that I could not do this on my own. So, you know, I conned my friend out of $20. You know, I said it was for gas money and it was for booze money. And I went to the bar and, you know, $20 didn't get me too far. And, you know, so I made some friends at the bar and continued to drink at their house. And I remember this moment, you know, when we have these moments, and my old sponsor used to say, you know, God meets us at our willingness. And that's so powerful for me today because, you know, in that moment, you know, on October 12th by then, 2007, I don't know if I really wanted to get sober, but I could not live the way that I was living. And I had said some form of some prayer, you know, which was just, you know, asking something greater than me to help me because I clearly could not help myself. You know, I had this moment of clarity and I looked around the room and it's like, have you guys ever been at like a party and you're going on and then they flip the lights on and you're like, oh shit. Yeah, it was one of those moments. Like, what did I get myself into? Why am I here? Oh, it's my life. And it's just like, you just want them to turn the lights back on or back off so you don't have to look at it, but you can't unsee what you just saw. And that's what I experienced in that moment. You know, I couldn't unsee what I had seen in my life. You know, I couldn't look in the mirror. I couldn't face myself. I couldn't face my family. I couldn't do anything. And I just remember the prayer was like, God help. I cannot live like this. And the thing is, on October 13th, when I did get sober, I woke up. And I remember I had two options. And the thing is before I took my first drink, I had gotten an academic scholarship to go to CU Boulder. And I left CU Boulder because, you know, I wanted to go live with a drug dealer because that seemed like a way better option than actually, you know, academic pursuits at the time. And, you know, I was going to go to Spain. I was going to do all these great things with my life. And here I was thinking I only had two options, and it was to get drunk or to kill myself. And I really believe that for us, with this disease of alcoholism, this obsession of the mind, and this restless or discontent, you know, there's really only three options for me to quiet that disease. You know, door number one is to drink. Door number two, well, dying shuts off the disease. And door number three is having a spiritual experience, you know, that changes my life because I'm spiritually sick. And so, you know, that morning, I took door number three and I went down to York Street. And if you're ever in Denver, you know, York Street is a really beautiful club. And I went down to York Street and I sat there and I cried my eyes out. And I raised my hand and I said, I'm new. And I, you know, I thought AA failed me, but I had no other options. And I remember sitting in that chair, bawling and praying. I hope this works. And I sincerely wanted it to work. You know, and the beautiful thing is that the truth is I haven't had a drink since. Because this program sincerely works if you work it. And so I got a sponsor and, I got a sponsor based upon outside things. And, you know, when that didn't work out, I decided to sponsor myself for a few months and I'd go to meetings and I'd like raise my hand and I, you know, to sponsor people. Cause I, you know, I was sponsoring myself. So I thought I knew everything. And there was this woman and this woman saved my life. And she had 28 years, which, you know, scared the crap out of me then. And she came up to me after a meeting and she said, would you like to come have coffee at my house? And I thought, well, you know, this seems like a, you know, bored old lady. Maybe I'll just go entertain her for a while. And so I showed up to her house and she sat down and she told me her story and she pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, would you like to read this book with me? And I said, yes. And she went over a few things and she said, first off, you know, you need to be willing to go to any lengths. I know you're willing to go to any lengths to get drunk. So you need to be willing to go to any lengths for this. She said, also, you need to tell me the truth even if it hurts. And she said, I'm going to tell you the truth even if it hurts you. Which was really important because she didn't care about my feelings when she told me, you know, how things were. And but she did it with such love and such grace. And, you know, I was really embarrassed at first when we started working the steps because I was like, but I've gone to college. Like, I know how to read, you know. But, like, I needed this, like, sponsor to walk me through and really get down to, like, what the book was saying. And, you know, I've been sober a while. And the thing is that we continue to grow and things look different. You know, and we do what we can when we can. And I don't think I ever did the steps wrong in the fact that I continued to do them through the book. But I remember the first time that I had to do, you know, because step one was easier because I could say, like, I'm an alcoholic. The unmanageable part, I still wanted to hang on to managing my own life. But, like, step two, all I could really come up with a concept for a power greater than me was the Rocky Mountains and the Beatles, you know? Like, I don't know if any of y'all ever heard some of the Beatles music, but that's stirred my soul. So I had to believe that that was something powerful, more powerful than me, you know? And I turned my will and my life over to it, and I did my first inventory, and, you know, which was mostly, I was resentful at me and my mom. Then my life changed, you know? I did the steps, I did all the way 1 through 12. And then I kind of became a poster child of AA. You know, I was like, cool, like, I got my job back. I got married. I got all of these cool promises. And I started to get complacent. And, you know, in the whole meantime, I started a career teaching. And I remember having to drive by the hotel that I used to do drugs in to go teach. And I thought, this is insane. Like, why would anybody let me buy their children? But it was a leap of faith that God had a bigger plan for me. You know, and so I had gotten all these things, and that's the thing, is I spent the first few years in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to, like, just look good. Just like that same woman that I talked about in the beginning that went back out. I just wanted my outsides to look good, because if my outsides look good, that meant that you had to love me. And for me today, it just looks different. And so what ended up happening is that at 4 years sober, I got divorced. And I remember bawling in my room and just being like, it was a hit the floor kind of feeling of like, well, God, if you're there, you know, teach me how to love. I really believed in that prayer that I was gonna get a Brazilian boyfriend after that. Instead, I got three sponsees. So, you know, these three women showed up in my life. And one of them in particular is really important. Important in the fact of, you know, we worked the steps together, you know, 1 through 12, and I never knew what to tell her half the time. I just would get there early and pray, and, you know, she was willing and I was willing, and, you know, we were honest with each other just in the same way that I was with my sponsor. And the whole time, I didn't realize that even though I didn't have this perfect sobriety that I thought I did, I had sobriety. And my old sponsor used to tell me, if you just don't drink, Victoria, you have a chance. You have a chance no matter how far down that scale you go, even in sobriety, because you will go down it in sobriety, you have a chance to come back up. And so this gal that I sponsored was from New Hampshire, and she was on a geographical to Colorado. And, you know, she got her life back together and all these cool promises, and she went back to New Hampshire. And so I went back to sponsoring myself for 3 years. And in those 3 years, it got really dark, and I got really dry. I didn't go to meetings. I didn't, you know, show up. I didn't do anything. And if you hear people when they share about their relapse, usually the first thing you hear is, I stopped going to meetings. And I did that. I stopped going to meetings. I didn't feel close to God. And so what ended up happening is that I started hanging out in bars, but not drinking, which is really not fun. And I started lying. I got really dishonest. And I was so shameful about it, because I thought, you know, if I popped up and picked up my year chip, I was like, hey guys, everything's good. It's okay. I'm good. I'm fine. You know, freaked out, insecure, neurotic, emotional, all that. But I'm fine. Don't worry. And, you know, I started getting dishonest. And what ended up happening for me in sobriety, after all these promises, after all these cool things happened, is that I thought about drinking a lot again. And I was dating someone at the time, and I lied to him. I told him that I drank. And I remember him bringing over a bottle of wine. And he said, this is a gift for you. And me thinking, well, I can't turn down a gift. And so I remember him pouring it. And there's this line in the book that talks about that there will be a time where there will not be, that the defense must come from a power greater than you. That you on your own cannot keep yourself sober, and that a higher power will be your only defense. And I remember sitting there and thinking, all right, well, I'm really miserable. You know, I'm moving to New Hampshire soon. Maybe I can just pick up this drink. Nobody will know. And I pick up the glass, I'm ready to drink, and my sponsor calls. It's kind of a buzzkill. So I put down the glass, and I go into the room, and I'm crying, and she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, I want a drink. I said, I'm so miserable. And this was the kind of sponsor, that's how I knew it was God, is because this was the kind of sponsor that she didn't call you, because you had to call her, because you needed to show her that you were willing. So I'm crying and I'm bawling, and she's like, well, don't drink, because what about the people at your home group? And I was like, I don't care about the people in my home group. She's like, what about your family? I was like, I don't care what my family thinks. She's like, what about those newcomers that you're going to help when you go to New Hampshire? And I hit the floor. I hit my knees. And I thought, that's the power of this thing. And that's why the fellowship is a key thing in this, is that sometimes it doesn't feel enough for me to stay sober for my own, but to have the ability to help another human being, another alcoholic, is so powerful that was enough. And I remember, you know, hanging up with her and being like, okay, I can do this. You know, and why I was going to New Hampshire is that in Colorado, I was so dry and I was miserable. And I remember reaching out to this girl that I used to sponsor, and I called her and I told her I was planning on drinking, you know, a few weeks prior to the wine. And she had said, "Victoria, why don't you come and move out to New Hampshire? You have so much to offer and you can help people out here. And you could get out of your own head. Because, you know, eating Taco Bell every day and watching Big Bang Theory is not, you know, really living." You know, she's like quoting the Big Book, like, "You're not packing anything into the mainstream of life." And I'm like, "Where'd you get that?" She's like, "You taught me." And so I don't share that, you know, a lot of times people ask me why I spent, you know, 3 years in New Hampshire. And the truth is I did it because I was willing to go to any lengths for sobriety. And I became this person that instead of running away from things, I ran to something. I would visit there often to visit her, and I felt God in the trees. I just felt so grounded and so centered, and I wanted that. And I knew I needed that, that I was so willing to just pack up my life and my dog and drive across country in the middle of the worst winter ever to move to New England. And so when I showed up in New England, the thing is I had some growing to do. I had some spiritual heavy lifting to do. And the thing is God, for me, I love the acronym Great Outdoors. It's kind of fitting where we're at right now. You know, I needed to experience God, and I needed to learn how to have a relationship with God, because that's what I was missing. You know, I was so busy trying to have a relationship with, you know, a guy, or, you know, make my work relationships look good or my family relationships look good, that I was cutting out the most important relationship. And so I moved to this little town in New Hampshire with like 1,000 people in the woods on 5 acres with my dog. And I started this period of life that I like to call me, God, and dog. And I love that dog is God spelled backwards. And I got to learn how to have this relationship through my dog, you know, because my dog is pretty stubborn. And he would like to run away a lot. He didn't like to be leashed. He'd chew through leashes. He'd run away, and I get like frustrated, and I'm just like flipping out about it. And my sponsor in New Hampshire would tell me, "Well, but he always comes back, doesn't he?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah." And then she's like, "How about you start thinking about maybe that's how sometimes God feels about you, especially in the frustration of you going off and doing these things that are hurting you." And for a long time, because of how I was raised, I thought that, you know, God wanted me to be this like Stepford Wife robot person, that I was like, the best I was gonna get from God was living in a box. And, you know, for me, she would tell me that God wants the best for me. And it took me a long time to believe that. And she would tell me things like, "You know how you intervene when your dog's like running?" She's like, "You intervene when it's a matter of his safety. But most of the time, you want him to like have that happy, joyous, and free spirit that he has, because he loves to run. That's what, you know, he was made to do." And she's like, "Think about God like that with you. Like, God just wants you to have that happy, joyous, and free, and beautiful spirit that you are, and to be that, and to have that in life. That sometimes God might intervene in your life because it's a matter of safety. Sometimes God might be like, don't go down that street, don't date that guy, don't move to that place, don't take that job. You know, rejection is God's protection." And that's what I started to experience there. And so I got involved in NECIPA, which is the New Hampshire or New England Conference of Young People in AA. And I got voted outreach chair, which meant that I had to go places and not hide out in my house. And so I traveled all around New Hampshire or New England. And what ended up happening is that I started to surrender, and I started to really trust that there was this power greater than me that I didn't need to define. I didn't need, you know, it didn't need to be a person. It didn't need to, you know, I didn't need to figure out the qualities. I just needed to have an experience with it and invite this higher power into my life and like let them drive the bus, you know. I imagine it as a rowboat. So I would say like, you know, I do my little rowboat and God's got, you know, their oar and I've got mine. And so I went from being lonely and insecure and afraid to having people show up at my house for bonfires from all over New England and staying, and we'd like make pancakes and stay up all night and talk about recovery. And I got to see people get well again, and I got to see myself get well again. And then this last year of sobriety has been so, so hard. And I'll back up a little in that I had spent a number of years cleaning up the wreckage of my past, particularly with my family. I did not like my mom when I first got sober. She was, in my mind, she was the reason that I was the way that I was and that I needed to drink. And so I did a lot of work around her, and I remember making amends to her and, you know, and then not talking to her for a couple years because we just couldn't, we just weren't able to really communicate with each other in a way that was good for either of us. And I remember my sponsor at the time telling me, you know, this is gonna work on God's time, and you just do your part and you give it to God. And so when I moved to New Hampshire, my mom wanted to come with me, and I didn't want her to come, but it just seemed right. And we bonded, and we became super close. And my mom made amends to me. My mom's not an alcoholic, you know. She works another program, but you know, she made amends to me for how things were when I was growing up. And it was so powerful. I did not realize the power of amends until that happened to me, because looking in her eyes and seeing her tears, everything just fell. Like everything fell away. You know, and it all came from just this matter of willingness. And so this last year, my mom got diagnosed with breast cancer. And I moved back to Colorado, and I couldn't find a job. And I was so mad. But I look back and I realize that once again, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And the fact of, I got to go to her treatments every single day. I got to hang out at the hospital with her. I got to hold her hand, and I got to be there. Because I spent so many years checked out, running away from my family, that I get to be present today. Because for me, sobriety is living a life of authenticity. And what that authenticity means, that I get to show up real, but I also get to experience life, which sometimes it's hard and it's painful. And so, you know, I was there, and I got to make another amends to my mom. And the beautiful thing about that is today, as I think about, there was this period of time that I hated my mom, and now she is one of my favorite people, if not the person I'm closest to. And she just texted me before this, and she just was like, good luck. And she said, you know, you should tell them that you were really crazy and that you were not a nice person, and that today you're a woman full of talent and beauty and grace and dignity, and that I couldn't be prouder to have you as my daughter. And you know, when I think about all the things that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, the list goes on and on. Because what ends up happening if you stick around here, you know, if you do this work, if you have a spiritual experience, life gets way more better than anything that a drink or a drug could ever touch. You know, the feelings that I get, even just from this weekend and being here, is far better than any high I ever had. You know, and I tried. So, you know, kind of in closing, I just want to, you know, touch on where I've been the last few months. I started working the steps again about a year ago with a sponsor when I moved back to Colorado. And this time, and I love that saying, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears, you know, because I kind of like did the a la carte, like the half-ass steps for a while, and it was enough, but it wasn't enough to really get that deep serenity and that deep peace and like what I really wanted, you know, because I don't ever want to drink again, and I knew that I needed to really dig deep for that, you know, to for to have that spiritual experience to allow me to, you know, have long-term sobriety. And so I moved back, and I moved back to the mountains in Evergreen. And I had a temporary sponsor when I was moving across country, and she had said, oh, one of our old friends from our original home group lives in Evergreen, you should call her, i.e. she should probably be your sponsor. And so I called her, we started working this process of steps, and we talked a lot about the thinking. And I had no idea how much my thinking really impacted me. And so I recently did another step three. And I'm from Boulder, but I've only recently moved back to Boulder. And this was the first time in all of my sobriety that it wasn't important what God was, because there's that line, God is everything or God's nothing. And I was like, challenge accepted. That's like a spiritual, like, you know, challenge. Because I spent so long in my sobriety trying to prove that God was nothing that I kept forgetting that God is everything. And what that means is God's either nothing or God's everything. And for me, you know, God is everything. You know, all those little, like, God's in the details. And so I did this third step, and I finally was willing to turn everything over, not just like the parts that I wanted. You know, the drugs and alcohol was easy to turn over in a third step. You know, relationships, job, money, that was a little harder to do. But I was so willing because I just trusted that, you know, I got this concept that was so amazing that I just trusted it, that it revels and delights in blessing me and giving me the best life possible. And that this higher power that I have today, that I choose to call God, just loves me unconditionally, flaws and all. And it has always been there, you know, much like the fish that searches for water to find that it's been surrounded by it the whole time. And so when I did this third step, it was so powerful in that everything changed. I got back into CU, the school that I left years ago, to go, you know, to live with a drug dealer. I got back into CU. They said the process would take 2 weeks. It took 2 days. I found an apartment in Boulder. And the thing is that's how big God is for me and like how God works today. Like, I knew I had to move to Boulder because I just got back into CU. I was like so nervous because like I didn't want to put anything on Craigslist because like, you know, weed is legal in Colorado. And I was just really nervous about what I could, you know, find in a roommate. And I didn't even have to like do anything. You know, the things came to me. You know, somebody had called me and said, we have a treatment out there called Harmony. And they had said, this woman just got out of Harmony and she really, really wants a roommate that's been sober a little while because she's really serious about recovery. And I had just told a friend that I had gotten into CU and I wanted to move to Boulder. I hadn't even like posted it out there to the world. I told one person. And then she gave me that woman's number, and 2 weeks later I moved to Boulder. And then, you know, after a year of being unemployed, you know, my mom found out she was cancer-free, and then the next day I got a full-time job teaching. You know, and for me today, what I really realize is that in this program, I just have to show up, do the work, and trust my higher power with the results. And that the greatest things are the things that come to me. They're not the things that I chase. I spent so long chasing things. I thought that if I could just catch this, then I'd be happy. And the thing is all the things that I thought that I had to catch to be happy, I don't have. You know, I don't have that relationship that I thought I needed to be happy. I don't have, you know, the tons of money that I thought I needed to be happy. And I'm so happy. And I'm happy because I'm happy within myself. You know, that person, like the love of my life that I've been looking for all along, I found it inside myself. You know, and there's a line in the book that talks about deep down in every man, woman, child is a fundamental idea of God. What that means to me today is that there's a part of God in me, that I am magic. And that the thing is that we do this program, our lives change and they get really amazing and they get really good, But it doesn't end there. We have to give it away to keep it. And giving it away, you know, looks like for me. About a week ago, I was on the Boulder bid for CC Pod, and we didn't get the bid, and you know, we were a little sad about it. We'd put a lot of work into it. And one of our bid members is in China studying abroad right now. And I couldn't sleep. For some reason, I couldn't sleep. Maybe I was stressed out about that, but I couldn't sleep. And he texted me at 3 a.m. Because it was a reasonable time in China. And I called him because I said, I feel like I really need to talk to you right now on the phone, not just like a text. So we talked on the phone for a little bit. And I gave him a pep talk. And as I was meditating today and kind of walking through the woods and trying to think about some of the things that I would share tonight, he sent me a text and he said, you know, Victoria, that's how big this program is and that's how big God is. He said, you know, I was talking to you on the phone and this guy from Beijing, because that's where he was at, came up to me after and he said, were you talking about Alcoholics Anonymous? And my friend was like, yeah. And he said, this guy was like, I think I have a drinking problem. Can you help me? That all I did was pick up the phone because it felt like what I needed to do. And he sent me another text and he said, that guy's got a week now and he got a big book and he wants to work the steps and he wants his life to change. You know, when I got here, I didn't know if I wanted to be sober forever because I was so young. I was 23. Like, you know, not drinking for the rest of my life seemed like a really long time and really scary. But I wanted a different life. And I've been given a life beyond my wildest dreams. Not even just like the things that I thought I wanted. And I'm just so grateful for everything that I have. And in closing, I kind of want to read my favorite story. It's a piece from The Keys to the Kingdom. And it's something that just sums up so much about this program and the gifts that we get. And the thing is that some of those gifts, a lot of those gifts for me are not material. They're the spiritual gifts. They're the gifts in the bonds that we have. They're the gifts in, you know, being able to help save, you know, another person's life just by picking up the phone. All right, so Keys to the Kingdom. This is found on page 275. And this very much describes for me what really living sober is. You know, I got the opportunity to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a life today. A life that if I pick up a drink, it's gone. And it would be like going to Vegas, betting everything that I have for just one drink and losing. And those are really shitty odds. So, AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life, and the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as they live. We do not, and we cannot, outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other, it is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line, and we find that we are compensated for constant effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we're used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves in accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience the thrill of challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques. We find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. The last years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had a share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that's life. But I've also known a great deal of joy, peace, and that is the handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, I have an unusual quality of fellowship, for to these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain, despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. As the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love. A love without strings, a love without obligation. We require relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. That ache is gone and never need to return again. Now, there is a sense of belonging and being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.